Yours now, too. He had trouble thinking of Lafarge as a spy, but that was just what he'd made her. Lafarge was an agent now, at least officially, but now he was worried about how she would handle the situation he'd put her in. Holston had lured her to the operation, persuaded her to join Confederation Intelligence, but he knew she lacked experience in espionage, not to mention the assorted skill sets his people called tradecraft. That didn't mean she was helpless, not by a long shot. She was a fierce and capable fighter, an accomplished spaceship pilot, and an expert on working the slime pit of the Confederation's Badlands border. Those last skills were not unlike intelligence work, but they weren't exactly the same thing either. He'd done his best to bring her into this, but now guilt was preying on him. And he had been bored, having some trouble adjusting to retirement, and he had used that to get to her, to convince her to come back to Daneth. Andy Lafarge doesn't do anything she doesn't want to do. He knew there was truth to the thoughts his mind had shoved forth in defense of his actions. Still, he was well aware that she wouldn't be on Daneth now, in some mysterious vehicle, possibly a prisoner, possibly facing imminent death, if he hadn't gone to Tellurus and lured her there. The dot turned, moving on to the main street leaving the city. He'd been on the verge of ordering his people in for the last 15 minutes, but now he decided. If he let the transport get too far out of the city, his talking units would stick out like flashing lights amid the lesser traffic. All units move in and intercept, and remember one of our people is in that vehicle, so stun guns only. He turned and looked to the front of the cabin toward the driver. We're moving in. Get us up there, now. He reached down to the seat, scooping up the weapon he'd set next to him. It was a stun gun, fully charged. Holston couldn't remember the last time he'd been so close to the action in an operation, but he felt responsible for Andy, and he'd promised himself he would be in the field with her, close by, ready to come to her aid any time she needed it. Like now. The vehicle accelerated, moving to the side to pass several others. Holston could see the transport carrying Andy just ahead. As he was watching, he saw three of his vehicles converge, one pulling in front, completely blocking the target's path. He reached over and opened the hatch, climbing out, even as his peripheral vision caught almost 24 of his people, armed agents and very heavily armed Marines, moving up on the vehicle. He was expecting some kind of resistance, perhaps even a hostage situation as whoever was in the surrounded transport held Andy at gunpoint. But there was nothing. No activity at all, save his people advancing right up to the transport. Then the hatch opened and a man came out, his hands high in the air. He was older, perhaps 70, wearing a simple nondescript outfit. And he was shaking, clearly terrified. Not at all what Holston had expected. He raced up toward the vehicle, and as he approached, one of his people turned and walked over to him. Isaac Stewart, the ranking agent on the op. There's no one else in the transport, sir. This man claims he is the owner of a store on the promenade. His documentation seems to check out, sir, and the vehicle is registered to the store. Holston's mind raced. We picked up Andy Lafarge's tracker in that truck. I want it searched, completely. It was a needless command, he knew. His people were already well into the effort. He moved up, looked over at where several agents were questioning the clearly stunned driver. He was staring through the open hatch into the battered old truck when one of the agents said, Found it, sir. The man walked right up to Holston and extended his arm. He was holding a small bit of metal, streaked with red marks, clearly half-dried blood. Holston looked at the tracker and his stomach tightened as cold realization set in. Whoever had Andy had removed the device, painfully, he suspected, and planted it in this transport. They hoodwinked me. He looked around, at the transport, at the driver. He was sure the man had nothing to do with any of this, though he intended to make absolutely sure. He'd been taken once and he wasn't about to let it happen again. He was angry, sick with worry. He was responsible for Andy being involved in any of this, and now he had no idea where she was. Her captors could be anywhere in Port Royal, even out beyond city limits by now. He'd lost her. Agent Stewart, he snapped. Yes, sir. Stewart had moved back toward the driver, but now he turned and rushed back to Holston. I want a priority Alpha alert declared at once. Stewart looked back, a stunned expression on his face. Sir, we'll need the planetary governor to sign off on that order to sustain Alpha status. Then get it. I don't care if you have to shove a gun in his mouth to do it. He paused, then added, This is all in my personal responsibility, Isaac. Just get it done now. I've got a naval task force in the system. Get the order to them. I want a complete blockade in effect now. No ships land or take off from Danith until further notice. Not even a garbage scow. Is that clear? Stuart nodded and then said, Yes, sir. The agent was clearly nervous, but he snapped off a crisp nod and moved back toward his agents, blasting out orders. Holston sighed softly. He was stirring up a real hornet's nest, he was sure of that. He'd just ordered an entire planet embargoed. He had the authority, but only in the face of a grave threat to national security. He didn't imagine the Senate committee that would investigate his actions would consider one missing agent sufficient grounds for such sweeping action. And he didn't give a shit. He was responsible for Andy LaFarge being there and for whatever trouble she was in now, and he was going to find her if he had to tear Danith apart one building at a time to do it. Damned the consequences. If the Senate wanted to take him down over it, he'd bring more than one of the pompous fools with him. Chapter 14 CFS Dauntless Z-4 System Year 315 AC
I'm as sure as I can be, sir. I've run half a dozen different tests. That thing's hull is an alloy we've never seen before, something beyond our science at present, and that means I can't be absolutely sure. But based on every data point we've been able to establish, my best guess is that the artifact is somewhere between 100 and 150 years old.
Thanks, Fritzy. I know your people have been working around the clock. Baron was tense. He'd reconvened his senior personnel now that Fritz and her people had run more tests. There were a number of potential implications from what his top engineer had just reported, but none he could think of were good.
Of course, sir.
Baron looked out across the conference table. Any thoughts? We're short on answers, so any ideas are welcome.
It could be from some kind of automated production facility that's still operating, or that was still running a century ago.
Sarah Eaton didn't sound at all convinced, even as she made the suggestion.
Without incoming raw materials or other manufactured parts? And how did it get here? Not to mention whoever programmed it would have been scheduling routine production more than 200 years in advance.
Atar Travis shook her head as she spoke. We need to consider every possibility, no matter how bizarre it sounds. Captain Fritz was clear that this alloy is new to her. We haven't satisfactorily penetrated the hull yet with our scans, and we haven't disassembled any parts of the device, so we don't have the whole picture. Perhaps it has some kind of anti-aging process, something that interferes with the tests we've done or slows normal decay. The likeliest explanation was simply that Fritz had somehow miscalculated, and the device was older than she thought. Perhaps the artifact had been produced just before the cataclysm. That would make it something like 375 years old. But Baron didn't believe it. Not really. Fritz might not be familiar with the metal, but it was normal matter, and she had done intense subatomic scans. He'd seen her work for too long to convince himself she had made an error. There is another possibility, one we have not discussed. Baron looked across the table at Globus, and he knew just what the Palatian was thinking. We have assumed there were no survivors of the cataclysm outside your own sector of space, but there has never been any real evidence to that effect, has there?
Are you saying the Empire is still out there? Travis asked, shrunken but still inhabited.
Well, that's a possibility, albeit an unlikely one. Based on what we do know of the cataclysm, it is hard to imagine that the ancient political entity survived.
Globus turned and looked over at Baron.
But isn't it possible that more than one pocket of survivors remained? If our sector could escape extinction, why not another? We don't even have reliable data on how big the Empire was. We have to accept that we really don't know what is out there.
Baron found himself nodding gently. Globus surprised him with the calm, studied nature of his statement. The Palatian was the last one he'd expected to make such a suggestion. The Alliance was out beyond the rim, and it had far less in the way of legends and histories of the old Empire and the Cataclysm than its coreward neighbors, at least until the treaty with the Confederation opened up the exchange of information. Globus had apparently taken advantage of that fact and educated himself before the mission, and Baron had to admit to himself he was surprised.
Perhaps there's some remnant of the Empire remaining after all, or some other sector where elements of civilization survived.
Baron paused. The entire idea was a bit overwhelming.
Or maybe some undocumented group of explorers ventured out from our worlds and pressed far more deeply into the Badlands than we'd previously suspected. They could have found enough old tech to establish themselves, at least temporarily.
Perhaps we found something they constructed. They might even have died out eventually, which would explain the lack of any contact in the intervening years. This could be something they left behind. Baron felt like he was babbling, but he had no idea what else to do. It doesn't matter which of these possibilities is correct, if any of them are, but one thing is certain. He hesitated again, and when he continued, his voice was deeper, more somber. Our mission just became exponentially more complex and dangerous.
Yes, Globus said, nodding. There is no question about that.
What do we know about that energy flash Captain Stockton saw? Could it have been some kind of communication beam? I fear we have to be concerned not only with what may be out there, but with whether or not they know we are here. Baron had sent Eaton and Globus back to their ships. The fleet was setting out in a few hours, and the two officers would be taking the lead, their ships the first to move through the transit point and into whatever system lay beyond. He'd asked a few of his people, old Dauntless crew all, to come back to his office for one more discussion before he gave the final order to advance.
We can't be sure what Captain Stockton saw or thought he saw. His fighter's malfunctions cost us any data he might have tried to record.
Anya Fritz sat at the end of a small couch on the wall across from Baron's desk.
I did everything I could, but the banks were wiped clean.
Data or no data, I'm telling you, I saw an energy spike.
Stockton turned his head, looking around the room. I'm sure of it. Nobody doubts what you saw, Jake. We're just trying to figure out what it could have been. Perhaps the thing was scanning you again, or maybe it was searching a different area.
I suppose that's possible, sir, but I don't think so. It was different the second time. I didn't have time to check the readings, but it wasn't acting like a scan.
You think it was a communication of some kind, don't you?
Atara Travis was sitting next to Stockton, and she turned to face him as she spoke. Stockton paused for a few seconds, looking uncomfortable.
Yes, he finally said. Then, but I can't guess its purpose. My first thought was that there was something else in the system, but we've conducted a thorough search and we haven't found a thing.
Stockton had directed that operation himself, and he'd had almost 300 fighters scouring what seemed like every cubic meter of the system. His people had scoured those areas far too closely to have missed anything.
If there was some kind of force hidden somewhere, if that was a distress call you detected, it seems likely that whatever was out there would have responded in some detectable way by now. Could it have been an attempt to send a message through the transit point to the next system, or beyond?
Anya Fritz seemed to be deep in thought even as she spoke. How would that have been possible? Baron looked over at the engineer. There was no indication of any physical probe being launched. He turned his head toward Stockton. You didn't get any readings on anything like that, did you, Jake?
No, sir, just an energy surge. Nothing material. I was within 800 kilometers. I can't imagine something physical could have escaped detection at that range.
Stockton shook his head.
And our patrols would have detected any kind of relay station located near one of the transit points. There was nothing.
Baron glanced down, looking at the patrol reports on the tablet sitting on his desk. Transit points were poorly understood, a vestige of man's vastly more advanced past. No one knew if the Empire had constructed them, or if they were the legacy of some totally unknown earlier civilization. But in more than two centuries of usage during recorded post-cataclysmic history, a few things had been discovered about the portals and how they functioned. And one of those was that only physical objects could pass through. No signal beams or any kind of pure energy had ever passed through a transit point from one system to another. At least not any known to Confederation science.
Fritzy.
Baron looked over at his engineer, but he paused, uncertain how to phrase what he wanted to say.
What can you tell us about experiments in sending communication signals through transit points? I know there have been research programs.
Fritzy shook her head.
I can't tell you anything, sir, except that as far as I know, every attempt to push any kind of raw energy or signals through a point has been a complete failure. As far as our science knows, the only way to send a message through a transit point is to carry it on a ship, or at least a drone of some kind, and nothing we've ever been able to observe has suggested otherwise.
But even though you feel this artifact is less advanced than something like the Pulsar, you believe it's ahead of us, don't you?
Yes, sir, I am sure of that. The alloy the hull is constructed from alone is stronger and lighter than anything comparable we've ever developed.
So then it is possible.
Sir?
It's possible that the artifact sent some kind of communication beam through the transit point using technology unknown to us.
Fritz sat for a moment, silent, looking uncomfortable.
I suppose it is possible, Admiral. We know far too little about the transit points to have any real idea what is or is not possible. All I can say is, every effort to do so in the past has been an utter failure.
I understand that, Fritzy, and I'm inclined to agree it's unlikely. Baron turned toward the others. But it is possible, and we cannot forget that.
What are you suggesting, sir?
Travis asked the question, but even as he listened, he'd have bet you knew the answer. No one got inside his head like Atar Travis did. Not even Andy. I'm suggesting there's at least a possibility that there were not only survivors long after the cataclysm, but that they may, in fact, still be out there, and that now they may know we're coming. He could feel the effect of his words hitting those present like a sledgehammer. He had some of the best and brightest the Confederation had to offer in the room with him, and he was sure the same thought had nagged at each of them. But he'd put it out there, brought the concern, the fear, to the forefront.
Well, sir, as unlikely as that seems, it would explain a number of things, wouldn't it?
Stockton had been silent since Baron had asked him about the energy readings, but now he spoke up.
Yes, Jake, I'm afraid it would.
Baron leaned back, pausing for a moment, clearly deep in thought.
It also complicates our decision now. This is an exploratory mission. Our primary purpose, other than gathering some historical data, is to find and recover any old tech we can. We discovered a few trinkets in some of the closer-in systems, and the device we discovered here is certainly of great interest. But now we have to decide whether to press on or head back to Megara.
Head back? It was Stockton again. How can we come all this way and go back with just one significant piece of old tech? We have to press on.
It was the brash pilot inside Stockton coming out, all bluster and bravado.
And what if we encounter more than an old automated scanning device? What if we run into something like the Planet Killer or the Pulsar? And what if this time there's someone else there operating it?
Baron's words silenced the room. He'd put everyone's biggest fear right out on the table.
Do you really think that's likely, sir?
Fritz asked. I don't know if I'd say likely, Fritzy, but I think it's just become a fringe possibility we have to take a lot more seriously.
It's your decision, of course, Admiral.
Atar Travis sounded uncharacteristically uncertain. Baron realized she didn't know what she would do in his shoes. He found that unnerving. All the years they'd served together, the dangers they'd faced, and this was the first time he'd seen her paralyzed by indecision. Baron had his own doubts as well, heavy ones. Concerns not only about what might happen to the fleet, but also what dangers he might provoke and where they might lead. He was never one to ignore problems and hope they would go away, but he'd never let fear rule his choices. His concerns were very real, but he'd already decided on a course of action.
We're moving ahead.
His tone was hard, a signal to all present that his decision was made and final. He turned and looked toward Stockton. Jake wanted to institute a number of new protocols, mostly extra security and fleet operations. First and foremost, I want a much heavier patrol rotation, including a substantial force of fighters well in advance of the fleet's lead elements. I want 4 squadrons on point at all times, except during transits. And I want a spread of drones put through each point before any ships follow.
Yes, Admiral.
Stockton's tone suggested he agreed fully. I will see to it. Baron turned and looked over at Stockton.
I'd like you to do more than that, Jake. I want you to transfer over to Repulse just temporarily. That way, you'll be able to keep a close watch on things. You've got command authority over every fighter in the fleet, so feel free to rotate squadrons as you need. We don't want to wear the pilots in the advance guard down to a nub.
Yes, Admiral. I agree completely. I will see to it.
I know you will, Jake. He nodded.
Fritzy, I want you to keep your crews working on that artifact.
His eyes moved toward Travis. Atara, have one of the escorts to take the device aboard. He thought for a moment.
Leopard, I think. She's one of the smallest, and I want her crew reduced down to a skeletal staff. Anyone not absolutely necessary for safe operation will be transferred to other ships.
Yes, sir. I will see to it.
Baron looked back at Fritz. Fritzy, I want your people shuttled on and off that ship for duty shifts. We still don't know for certain that the artifact is safe, and I'm not risking anyone who doesn't absolutely have to be there.
Understood, sir.
And Fritzy? Baron stared intently at his engineer.
That includes you. Do what you can to research the thing and manage your people. But when you're not doing that, I want you back on Dauntless.
He turned toward Star Sinclair. Star, I want you to make sure we've got enough shuttles doing runs back and forth to move personnel back and forth. And I want all engineering personnel off Leopard 20 minutes before each transit. Yes, Admiral. I'll put together a regular schedule to ferry Captain Fritz and her people back and forth between Dauntless and Leopard. It would help if Leopard could hold position within 5,000 kilometers of Dauntless. That should be far enough to protect her from any problem that might occur, and keeping the range down will simplify shuttle operations.
Very well. Baron turned toward Travis.
See to that flight plan, Atara. I want Dauntless's navigational AI running both ships.
Yes, sir. I'll see to it immediately.
Baron stood up.
Okay, we all know what we're doing, so let's get back to our stations. The advance guard will transit in...
He looked over at the chronometer on the far wall. 1 hour, 43 minutes. He turned toward Stockton.
Jake, that should just give you time to get over to Repulse if you take your fighter. I'd like you to be ready to get those scouting patrols up and out as soon as we get through the point.
Yes, sir. Consider it done.
I'm sorry not to give you more time, but we'll have to send anything you want over after the fleet transits. Transmit a list of personal gear you need, and I'll have one of the stewards collect it and shuttle it over right after the jump.
Thank you, sir. Stockton nodded as he answered. Baron turned toward Travis. Like everyone else in the room, she had followed his lead and stood up.
Atara, send a communique to Commodore Eaton. She is to launch a spread of drones immediately to explore the other side of the transit point. Her forces are to proceed on schedule without further orders, unless the drones discover something she deems to be of concern.
Yes, Admiral.
Okay, then. Let's go see what the hell is out there.
Chapter 15. Hall of the People. Liberté City. Planet Montmira, Gassara 4. Union Year 219, 315 AC. Villeneuve read the report, and the further he got, the wider the smile on his face became. Part of him still couldn't believe the luck he'd had in his desperate grab for survival and power. Ricard Lié's successful assassination of the Presidium had played a huge role, but he also credited himself with executing every subsequent step almost flawlessly. Still, he was not delusional enough to lose sight of the fact that fortune had played an enormous role, especially in the early stages. He knew just how easily he could have ended up under the boots of the mob rather than leading it. Luck or not, he was even more impressed with the job Ricard Lié had done with the workers' councils. The first small revolutionary groups had sprung up on their own, but instead of crushing them, Villeneuve had seen an opportunity to use them to his advantage. He'd started that process himself, gaining control of most of the large councils on Montmorail and the other close-in planets. But in just a few short weeks, Lié had put together hundreds of teams, and he dispatched agents to dozens of worlds, disguised as grassroots agitators and organizers, to extend clandestine influence throughout the rest of the Union. The cost had been high, at least in absolute terms, though many of the bribes to council leaders had come from the confiscated properties of former government members. The Union's economy was still too prostrate for Villeneuve to liquidate any significant amount of such property at any reasonable price. Those assets were far better used to extend his control, to lure those who'd loudly proclaimed the ideals of the revolution to sell themselves and become his cronies. A massive manor house he couldn't sell worked perfectly to entice a former revolutionary to corruption. He was still stunned at how effective the whole campaign had been. To date, fewer than 10% of the councils had resisted such infiltration, and the small number that had remained true to their stated ideals fell into the delicate hands of his trusted friend. Lié had accomplished every aspect of his mission, but it was in the handling of the most stubborn bodies that he had truly shined. Death was Ricard Lié's business, and as far as Villeneuve was concerned, his friend was without peers in his chosen profession. He could have killed recalcitrant council members in 100 ways, most of which would have been dangerous, and might have risked some kind of backlash. But Lié had avoided such pitfalls, and for the most part he'd manipulated the proscribed members into killing each other. It looked easy enough, on paper, though Villeneuve knew it was far more difficult and delicate in practice. Lié and his teams had arranged for incriminating documents and other evidence, most of it faked, to fall into the hands of each target's rivals. The denouncements had gone on for weeks now, as had the subsequent killings. Often Lié had used one problem member to denounce another, after which the first whistleblower was cast in turn to the mobs, condemned by evidence no less manufactured than that which they had used to denounce their own enemies. The mobs were still enraged, at least in the cities on most of the Union's core worlds. Their fury was ready to be unleashed on anyone.
It was always astonishing, and to Villeneuve reassuring, how little actual proof was required to turn people into wild throngs screaming for blood. Lee had accomplished an amazing amount in just a few weeks. The assassin, and new head of the People's Protectorate, was on Danith now, ready to begin the second assignment Villeneuve had given him. That planet was in every way the center of illicit exploration and black market activity for old tech. Villeneuve wished he could have kept his friend back in the Union to continue to assist him with his final efforts to secure control. But crushing resistance in the Union was only one task he needed to accomplish. The events of the war, as frustratingly unsuccessful as they'd been, had made one other thing absolutely clear to him. The possession of old tech would be the key to dominance in the future. He'd long been aided by the Confederation's foolish adherence to the treaties requiring nations to share any old tech items that came into their possession, regardless of where they had been discovered. Men like Van Stryker and Gary Holston had ignored such requirements, of course, at least when it had been vital to do so, and when they'd been able to get away with it. But the treaties had definitely hampered the Confederation's exploitation of old tech, and they had done so for almost a century. He was concerned about whether that advantage would continue, however. Certainly, the Confederation Senate was as ineffectual and politically fractured as ever. But it was Stryker and Holston, and others like them in the Confederation's halls of power, that most concerned him. Not to mention Tyler Barron and whatever his massive exploration fleet might find, hundreds of light years from the prying eyes of the Senate. Confederation politicians were largely fools, far too worried about their petty bickering to look seriously to the future. But he couldn't afford to assume that Holston and Stryker, and the others like them, would just sit back as he moved to gain an unbeatable advantage in old tech for the new Union. Unless they're preoccupied with something else. Marielis. Desiree Marielis was a gifted agent, one who combined unquestionable physical charms with a sharp, incisive mind, and an absolute lack of hesitation to do whatever was necessary. Next to Ricard Lié, he imagined she was the least afflicted by conscience and regret of anyone he'd ever known. She would be well on her way to Megara by now, assuming she managed to get through Confederation space undetected. It was dangerous enough for a Union agent to travel anywhere in the Confederation, but the capital world was a heavily regulated place, with customs agents and law enforcement everywhere. Lié suspected that had much to do with keeping out undesirables within the Confederation, as it did guarding against foreign spies. Confed politicians prattled on endlessly about equality and egalitarianism, but they were as corrupt and lived lives as luxurious as any of their equivalents in the Union. Hypocrisy was an affliction that seemed to afflict all humanity with relentless intensity. Despite his token worries, he was reasonably confident Marielis would make it to Megara. Her aliases were well-crafted, and the prep work had been completed to the highest standards. She would not only get there, she would cause trouble. He was sure of that. But her mission would be incredibly difficult to see to fruition. He glanced down at the tablet sitting in the center of his desk. The screen was blank, save for a title in nondescript white letters. Plan Black. He'd written the document himself, and he'd shared it with no one, at least not in its entirety. It was a second effort to undermine the Confederation, to gain the dominance he'd sought and failed to achieve in the war. Discovering one or more dominant old tech artifacts was still the likeliest route to victory, and the vengeance he craved on those who handed him his failures and defeats. But Plan Black was a backup, another route to total victory, to dominance over his hated enemies. He didn't expect complete success, not really, but even a partial attainment of the plan's goals would be helpful. And if Mariella somehow pulled the whole thing off, she'd go a long way toward erasing the defeat in the war, and moving the Union toward the uncontested dominance it had sought for a century. Villeneuve sat quietly as the door opened, and a tall man in a spotless naval uniform walked in. It had been a pleasant day so far, progress reports from both Marielis and Lié looking very good indeed. For the last hour, he'd been with Admiral Turenne, discussing something that had been a painful thorn in his side for almost 2 years now. He looked up at the new arrival. "Admiral Denisov, come in, have a seat." Villeneuve gestured toward one of the chairs facing his desk. It was old, hard metal, blemished by irregular oval-shaped rust stains along the back. All part of the image the Union's leading citizen wanted to portray.
"Thank you, sir, Citizen Villeneuve."
Denisov paused, noticing the man sitting in the second chair facing Villeneuve.
and Admiral Turenne. He was clearly surprised at the naval CO's presence, and he snapped to attention and saluted.
There is no need for such formalities here, Andre. I am sure Admiral Turenne would agree.
Of course, sir, the other admiral said. Actually, Villeneuve was fairly certain Turenne did not agree, not at all. Turenne was the closest thing to a hero the Union had seen in the battle at the bottleneck, and for all he was somewhat of a maverick, he'd shown that he expected a certain amount of respect from subordinates. Villeneuve had almost ordered the officer executed for failing to stop Dauntless. That would have been a terrible injustice to the one officer who'd come closest to safeguarding victory in the bottleneck. But Villeneuve had been blind with rage and ready to lash out at anyone. Fortunately, his reason had won out in the end. Turenne had actually detected Dauntless, or at least he'd gathered enough data to raise his suspicions that something was out there. So Villeneuve had satisfied himself by executing that fool, Admiral Bourbon, instead. And rather than having Turenne shot, he'd promoted him to the Navy's top command. That had meant leapfrogging him over a legion of superior officers, many of whom complained loudly and foolishly. Very few of those bypassed ultimately survived the revolutionary purges that followed. Denisov walked across the room and pulled out the offered chair, sitting as he'd been instructed to do. Denisov was clearly nervous as well as uncomfortable, not only at being summoned to Villeneuve's office, but also by the presence of his commanding officer. Villeneuve was amused by the admiral's twitching, a natural effort to assume a comfortable seated position. It was something that did not seem possible on the old battered chairs.
"I wanted to discuss a pending military operation with you, Admiral Denisov. Although we are at peace with the Confederation now, we have another matter, one which has gone on for far too long."
He stared across the desk at the admiral, noting the surprise and anticipation in the officer's expression. He didn't doubt for an instant Denisov knew what he was talking about, or that the admiral would fail to see that the mission he was about to receive was the prime assignment in the Navy, and that success in carrying it out would create a career trajectory directly to the very highest command echelons. That was seductive for any ambitious officer, but Denisov had only been a captain when the war ended, which made attaining such heights so soon particularly dizzying. Villeneuve's rage, and the need to keep feeding scapegoats to the mob, had ravaged the flag ranks badly since the fight at the bottleneck. Denisov was one of a group of formerly junior commanders who had exhibited a level of skill and ability beyond that of his peers, and Villeneuve had responded by giving him a huge promotion and putting him in charge of his own task force.
"Yes, sir, citizen. I will be honored to accept any mission you give me."
"I think we all know what we're talking about, Baou, Admiral."
"I suspected, sir."
"As you are aware, the traitors on Baou have defeated two attempts to liberate the planet. Until now, we have been unable to assemble a force sufficient to overcome the planet's defenses and re-establish control. I believe we are now capable of doing just that."
Denisov was silent for a moment, seemingly uncertain if Villeneuve was going to continue. But then after a quick glance at Turenne, he said,
"The problem on Baru has certainly gone on for far too long, sir. I couldn't agree more on the urgency of taking action as quickly as possible."
"I would like you to lead the assault force. Admiral Turenne had planned to do it himself, but I'm afraid he simply cannot be spared from the fleet's rebuilding efforts. We have a long way to go before we recover our pre-war strength."
"I understand completely, and I am honored to be given the chance to pacify Baru at last."
Denisov paused.
"May I ask what forces will be available for the operation?"
"Admiral Turenne will go over all of that with you in detail in a few minutes. I just wanted to have a few words with you first. I want to be certain that you do not underestimate the Baru forces. They may be vile traitors, but that doesn't mean they can't fight. Overconfidence has already caused two disastrous reconquest attempts. I do not want to see a third."
"No, sir."
Denisov sounded confident, but Villeneuve could hear some edginess in his tone as well. "Good. We don't need another fool not taking this seriously enough."
"We have significant People's Army units available for the operation. However, transport is of greater concern. I believe we can send 10 divisions to Baru. More than that will be difficult, at least in the near term. Diverting additional vessels to carry more troops will damage our ability to keep your forces properly supplied, an endeavor which will be difficult enough without any added problems.
I suspect it will take some time to truly pacify the planet, which puts an emphasis on our ability to keep your logistical line operating effectively.
Understood, sir. I believe 10 divisions of Hudra, of People's Army Forces, will be sufficient.
Denisov paused, clearly wanting to say something but unsure if he should.
Please, Admiral, speak your mind.
Well, sir, I'm more concerned with the orbital battle. Baru is a heavily defended planet, sir, and...
Another pause.
Well, sir, the previous assaults do not appear to have significantly degraded the defense network. I can't help but wonder if we will be able to concentrate sufficient forces for the attack, and I'm reluctant to proceed unless we are.
Villeneuve didn't answer immediately. He wasn't used to people questioning him, not even in the limited way Denisov just had. But he needed strong and capable subordinates now, not a pack of political appointees and cronies of the sort that had dominated the fleet before and during the war.
"You are extremely insightful, Admiral," he finally said. "No doubt your fleet will face significant resistance. We will give you every ship that can be spared, which I believe will be sufficient force. But it is up to you to find a way to take out the orbital forces and establish total space superiority prior to launching the ground assault."
"Yes, sir, I understand."
Villeneuve suspected the Admiral did actually understand. Villeneuve was giving him every hull he could scrape up. The pacification of Baru simply couldn't wait any longer. The nascent but growing People's Protectorate had done everything possible to prevent the rebellion there from spreading, but allowing a world to remain in open defiance of the new Union government was unsustainable. It would inspire other resistance sooner or later, and at this point, more likely sooner. Unless Denisov made an example of them with such grim intensity, the news of it spread farther and faster than word of the rebellion had.
"You must not only defeat them, Admiral, and retake the planet, you must do so in a way that leaves a lasting impression. On the citizens of Baru, of course, but also on those throughout the Union. Treason will not be tolerated."
"Yes, sir, I will do my best."
Villeneuve had selected Denisov because he believed the Admiral had the tactical skill to carry out the mission. Now he wondered if the man had the brutality it would take to exploit that victory.
"I am Shell Yuvel, Admiral." He glanced down at his desk. "Now if you will both excuse me, I have quite a backlog of other matters to address. Admiral Turan will discuss tactics and logistics with you at greater length. And timing as well. I'm afraid you will probably not have the amount of lead time you'd like. The invasion fleet will depart in 5 days."
Chapter 16. CFS Dauntless. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC. "We're about to complete orbital insertion, Admiral. The planet definitely looks habitable, and the ruins in orbit appear to be more extensive than we'd anticipated from initial scans. Our best guess is we're looking at the remains of a series of space stations destroyed long ago." Baron sat and listened to Sarah Eaton's report. It was more or less a one-sided communication. Eaton's advance guard was a full 8 light minutes ahead of the main fleet, and 16 minutes was one hell of an annoying lag time in any kind of a real conversation. "I've launched 20 spreads of probes as part of a comprehensive scan of the planet's atmosphere and surface. Based on the debris in orbit and preliminary ground readings, it appears likely we found a world that was once massively inhabited." Eden's words carried a heavy meaning that was not lost on Baron. Whatever space stations, or the remains of them, her ships had found, it was a far greater concentration than had been discovered around any world in the Badlands. Much greater. Debris, at least on the scale Eaton had reported, meant the stations hadn't been vaporized by massive nuclear and antimatter bombardments, and that exponentially increased the chance of finding usable old tech amid the ruins. It also meant this planet might have been a real Imperial world, not just a fringe outpost. For all the post-cataclysm success and prosperity of a planet like Megara, Baron didn't let himself lose sight of the fact that all the inhabited worlds he knew of had once been part of the Rim. Distant outposts so insignificant, they weren't even worth the trouble to obliterate when humanity was destroying itself. There were as many legends as facts about the Empire, but the thought of glimpsing the heights of power and technology mankind had attained before they'd thrown it away was beyond exciting to him. "I've also ordered Captain Stockton to launch 6 squadrons to conduct sensor sweeps in orbit and around the planet to back up the data from the drones. I'll report in full as soon as I have additional findings. Eaton out.
Baron leaned back in his chair and rubbed his hand across his face. Eden's ships had traversed the system from the transit point without incident, so he didn't see any reason for the rest of the fleet to hang back any longer. He turned toward Atara Travis.
Commander, let's get Dauntless's engines up and running, at 8G absolute thrust.
That was a modest rate of acceleration, at least in terms of the dampener's ability to absorb most of the resulting force.
Yes, sir.
Travis turned and leaned down over her own comm unit, passing Baron's order to her nav station. Baron remembered Travis relaying such commands without the comm unit before, but the new Dauntless was just too big for that, and the nav team was halfway across the cavernous control center.
Captain Eaton, fleet order. All ships are to match Dauntless's course and velocity. Maintain fleet formation. We're going in.
Baron had transferred Sarah Eaton's sister to Dauntless to act as his primary aide. It was a move that had come with a significant promotion, and one that had been motivated primarily by his great respect for Sarah, at least at first. But Baron had come to appreciate Sonya Eaton's abilities, and her even manner and cool demeanor. She'd adapted well to being a part of Baron's team, and she didn't seem to resent that in many ways. Atara Travis already functioned as his aide, in addition to her duties as Dauntless's captain. Eaton just filled in the blanks wherever she was needed, stepping aside when Baron and Travis worked together as they did so fluidly, and taking the fleet duties on to herself when they fell to her.
Yes, Admiral.
Eaton tapped her headset, connecting her to the fleet comm line, and she relayed Baron's orders. Baron sat quietly for a minute, his eyes fixed on the main display. Sarah Eaton was relaying preliminary scanner information, and he was getting his first actual view of the planet, along with early readings on things like atmosphere, climate, geography. It looked like a hospitable world right in the middle of the habitable range. In fact, based on what he could see, the planet seemed like it might be a virtual paradise. He glanced over at the data on the orbital debris. There were some very large chunks, 50 meters or more in length, that looked very much like pieces of orbital platforms. In their own way, they were as exciting as the planet itself. Wind and weather were hard on artifacts on the ground, but items floating in space were likely to be well preserved. This planet was the true start of the fleet's mission, the first real find. But even as he imagined how much farther his people could press on, he realized those chunks of floating debris alone could very well include enough old tech to radically advance civilization back home. And depending what the Confederation government decided to do, particularly regarding the interpretation of international law, what his people found here could radically alter the balance of power. Such a thing would be dire if the advantage fell to a power like the Union, or even possibly to his alliance allies. But a confederation with an overwhelming technological advantage could keep the peace, impose a Pax Confederica on the entire sector. He imagined a future without the wars that had plagued his people and their neighbors for centuries. He shook his head. He wondered if the Senate would break the treaty, keep anything he found for the Confederation's use alone. They would have to do that if the Confederation was to safeguard the peace. And then he wondered if he was being naive, if a Confederation suddenly in possession of overwhelming strength would indeed be a force for good and peace. Or if such power would corrupt all it touched, as history showed such things usually did.
We're getting fresh readings now, Commodore.
Eden turned her head toward the tactical officer station. She expected data, a lot of it. She'd launched a massive number of drones, too many, she'd thought after the fact. Her overreaction was normal enough, considering that the fleet had encountered two more scanning devices on their way to the planet, both situated adjacent to transit points, but the expedition had limited supplies and no way to replenish them anytime soon. She'd have to be more careful in her logistics going forward.
Feed it to the main display, Commander, and to my screen.
Yes, Commodore. Eden watched as a wave of information scrolled down the screen. Numbers, charts and tables, images. The planet looked pleasant enough. A blue globe streaked with stringy white clouds, not much different in appearance than Megara. The display was showing various views of the planet transmitted from the drones. The lead spread was just entering the atmosphere. The scanning devices were not equipped for atmospheric operations, which made descending somewhat of a suicide mission for the robotic probes. The images on the screen were dark at first, but then there was light, a blue sky that looked inviting and hospitable. The transmission became a little less stable as the probes penetrated deeper into the atmosphere, and the heat began to affect their instrumentation. The long-range cameras aboard were starting to pick up ground images.
The probes were still 15 kilometers from the ground, but now Eaton and her people were looking at images of vast forests and great oceans that extended out of sight. The picture on the display became fuzzier. She knew the probes would disintegrate in a few seconds, and she focused, staring intently at the deteriorating image. She was still staring when the display went dark, but even after the transmission terminated, she sat dead still, her eyes fixed on the dark screen. She'd seen something. And from the expressions she saw on the bridge, and the tense silence in the air, she wasn't the only one. "I want that last few seconds replayed, Commander, full AI enhancement, and run at 1/10 normal speed." "Yes, Commodore." She watched intently as the projection returned to the screen. The camera was moving over a large valley and then up and over one of the flanking hillsides. And there it was. "Freeze projection." "Yes, Commodore." She stared at the screen. Repulse's bridge was silent, every set of eyes fixed along with Eaton's. It was a city. Or at least what was left of one. There were chunks of metal jutting upward and vast fields of rubble. It had once been a massive metropolis, that much was clear, even larger than Troia's city on Megara. Much larger. There were lines extending out from the perimeter, looking very much like the remains of some kind of monorail or other transit system. Nature had since encroached, and vines and other plant growth had wrapped around the ruins. For an instant she imagined that the city had simply been abandoned, perhaps even as part of an exodus from the entire planet. But as she looked at the still image, the truth became all too apparent. The city had been destroyed by some kind of attack, almost certainly one with thermonuclear or even antimatter weapons. All that remained were scattered remnants and blasted and broken wreckage of buildings. She glanced at the numbers on the screen below the images, the calculations the AI had made and displayed. The city had been immense. It must have been the home to tens of millions of people at one time. And someone came here and obliterated it, killed all those people. She tried to imagine the attack, the sheer terror of the city's inhabitants, the fury and hatred that had driven someone to incinerate so many millions. She'd heard the cataclysm spoken of her entire life, but she'd never really considered what that word truly meant. Until now. Jake Stockton tapped his controls, altering his vector a few degrees to port. His fighters really didn't have much to do, and the situation certainly didn't call for his presence. But he'd taken advantage of the monumental nature of the find to lead the patrol himself. His fighters had done some recon duty earlier, but that had been mostly overkill on Commander Eaton's part. The Lightnings were designed primarily for combat and for routine scouting duties. The probes had scanners 10 times as powerful, as well as the ability to detect all sorts of things a fighter couldn't. The current mission was, if possible, even more useless. Eaton had displayed search teams to comb through the orbital wreckage. There was a lot of excitement in the fleet about what kinds of old tech they would discover. Almost every spacer in the fleet had been at the bottleneck, had faced death fighting against an old tech artifact. And as far as anything had been documented, no one had ever found anything as extensive as the apparent remains of the planet's space stations. He looked down at the tactical screen, checking on the rest of the patrol. He had been running the rookies hard since the fleet left Megara, but now he had only veteran pilots with him. Flying around so close to a planet and in and out of orbit was tricky, and the last thing he wanted to see was some green flyer slam into one of the chunks of debris. Everybody was where they were supposed to be. That was no surprise. The pilots on duty now had an average of 6 enemy kills in the war. They could handle a bunch of floating ruins. Stockton twisted his body, trying to stretch as well as he could. Years of service had taught him the best ways to stay loose in a Lightning, but the hard truth was there really weren't any good ways. That was a lesson he'd learned on the long-range probe missions he'd done. Pilots who complained to him about long scouting runs tended to get a lecture on just what it felt like to be in a cockpit for days without a break. "This is Team Alpha, contacting command." Stockton looked down at his control panel. Repulse was on the far side of the planet, and its orbit wouldn't bring it back around for another few minutes. That meant Stockton was command, at least for the moment. "This is Fighter Leader Team Alpha. I'm the closest thing to command you've got right now, so report." Sarah Eaton was a cautious officer. She'd brought Repulse into orbit alone, leaving the rest of the advance guard about 50,000 kilometers out. That wasn't far at all in terms of space travel, but it was a bit out of reach of a spacesuit's low-powered comm unit. Of course, if she was really cautious, she'd have kept her flagship back and sent in one of the other vessels. Sir, something is strange here. These are definitely chunks of some kind of station, and they're in pretty decent shape, too, but...
But what?
Well, there doesn't seem to be anything of... well, of value, sir.
What do you mean?
We've been through three sections, and it's the same everywhere. There are places that seem like they were work areas. We've even found a few workstations with their chairs still in place.
The voice went silent for a moment.
There's nothing in any of them, sir.
In any of them? No insides. There are workstations, but there's no circuitry inside. No computer equipment, just what looks like empty cabinets where that stuff would be.
Could it all have been destroyed? Something blew these stations apart, after all.
And left the cases intact? We've got whole panels and consoles, hardly damaged at all, but they're completely empty.
Stockton froze in his cockpit.
Are you saying someone removed them all, manually?
It sure looks that way, sir. We've only been in three of these, but I'm awfully curious to see what the others have found. Maybe this section was under maintenance or something when it was destroyed.
Maybe, Stockton said, not believing it for an instant.
Keep searching, and report back whatever you find.
Yes, sir.
He reached out and punched up the data on Repulsa's location. Another 14 minutes before the ship would be in direct line of sight.
No, that's too long. Commodore Eaton needs to hear this, now.
He grabbed the throttle, firing up his thrusters, and tapped his finger against the small comm keypad.
Beta team, do you read?
He was going to get all the information he could, and get it to Eaton now.
Beta team here, sir. I need a full report. What have you found?
He hadn't expected to discover much on this journey, but now he didn't know. He had no idea what to expect. No idea what they were up against out here.
Chapter 17. Baru City, capital of the Baru People's Republic. Baru, Rion 3. Union Year 219, 315 AC.
Alboron made it through, but I think that's going to be the last. Captain Higgs isn't even sure he wants to try to make the run back out.
If the fact he had a crew of outlaws as unexpected long-term guests didn't stress things enough to him, Mike Hoover could tell all he needed to know from Sylvia Breen's tone. He'd come to trust his number two, which was a rare thing in his trade.
So they finally managed to tighten the blockade? I guess we should be thankful it took them as long as it did.
It looks like the intel was right about that. They must have still been trying to finish repairs on their ships from the war. It does take a large force to mount an effective blockade.
He could hear the scorn in Breen's voice. The Confederation's entire fleet had been totally refitted for months now, save for a few ships with truly extensive damage. It was a stark contrast to the Union's continued efforts to get its fleets back to something like full readiness.
Which is an ironic advantage, since so many of our ships were just fixed up so they could be decommissioned.
Well, I guess it's not easy to conduct business as usual in the middle of a revolution. Hoover didn't know exactly what had happened in the rest of the Union since the end of the war. There had clearly been tremendous unrest. And yet Gaston Villeneuve was still at the top. If anything, the Sector 9 chief had more power than he'd had before. That was a sobering thought, and one that fostered a less than optimistic view of the prospects for long-term peace. It was also the main reason Hoover and his team were on Baru. The planet was the sharpest thorn in Villeneuve's side, and the longer the revolutionaries there could hold out, the greater the drain on Union resources.
No, I'm sure it's not. Unfortunately, from what little intel we can get here, Villeneuve has made great strides in quelling resistance on most of the old Union planets. He's gotten more industrial facilities and shipyards up and running again, which is probably why the blockade is finally closed.
Hoover forced a smile.
Which means we're stuck here, Sylv.
Yes, she replied, her own grin looking just as insincere.
Can't think of a nicer place. Still, we've got plenty of work left to do, so it's not like we were leaving any time soon.
True enough.
He sighed softly. He'd gotten seven ships through, which represented far more in the way of supplies and logistics than he'd dared to hope for. And for all the disorder still lingering from the revolution, the new defense network was coming along nicely. He'd put the simplest components into production first, the ones easiest to complete and deploy. That meant mostly laser satellites and disposable orbital insertion vehicles. There were 40 of the laser units in orbit already, and within a week or two, he'd have that number up to 100. Combined with Baru's already formidable fortresses, the planet would be a tough target for the Union. Which is a good thing, because I just as soon not be gunned down by rampaging Futur Rouge, or whatever the Union is calling its clone soldiers now. The People's Army, he thought he recalled from the last intel briefing before he'd left Megara. Mike? He could tell Breen was troubled about something, beyond the stress and danger of the mission. He knew what it was, too. The same thing that had been eating away at him for some time. Ever since he'd met with Henri Bernard. I know, Sylve, but our mission is clear, and to be brutally frank, that has nothing to do with what's best for Baru. I know that, Mike, but... She let her voice trail off. Hoover understood completely how she felt. He'd been inclined to believe Bernard from the minute he'd first met the man. Assessing people, deciding if they were trustworthy, was a huge part of his profession, and every instinct he had told him the resistance leader had told him the truth. Now, months later, he only believed that more. Garon and his people had treated Hoover's party well, but they had been clumsy in their attempts at subtlety and deception. The brutality of Baru's new regime was all too obvious. Hoover had lost count of how many people had been killed since he'd arrived, and those were the only ones he knew about. The planet had become divided, with Garon's people on one side and those like Bernard on the other. The vast majority of the population was in the middle, their lives no better than they had been under the Union, and their fear of Garon's enforcers even greater than what they'd felt for Sector 9. The Union had demanded obedience, but before the terrible shortages at the end of the war, workers who did their jobs could usually get by without too much trouble. Many of those around Caron seemed to crave spilling blood for its own sake. What could we do, even if we wanted to? It was an irrelevant question, one he knew he shouldn't even be asking. His mission was to protect Baru, and undermining Caron's government, however repugnant and brutal it was, certainly wasn't going to strengthen the planet's defenses. Open rebellion would only make a Union invasion that much easier. I don't know. You know, I've been on my share of missions, and some of those required doing things I didn't like. But I'm starting to hate myself, Mike. Caron and Delacorte, they're what we fight against. For all the lying and deceit we use on our mission, I never doubted that we were the good guys. She looked up at Hoover. Until now. Her words hit him hard. He'd never heard her say anything quite like what she just had, and he'd served alongside her on many missions. But mostly he realized he agreed with her completely. He was carrying out his mission, following his orders, and he was beginning to despise himself for it.
I'm worried, Remy. The resistance has been harder to finish off than I expected. They've got all cells across the planet, even in the capital city, and I'm certain they've made contact with our confederation guests.
Garon had rolled over, intending to get some sleep, but it was clear that wasn't going to happen, at least not until Amy had expressed her concerns. He looked at her, naked, covered only by a fine white silk sheet. He'd always resented the privileges the government officials had enjoyed while he and his peers worked 12-hour shifts and wore coarse old rags. Now he'd come to enjoy such things, and he'd quickly learned to appreciate the luxuries taken from the homes of the now-dead Union officials. He'd come to appreciate Amy Delacorte as well. She'd been a follower at first, and then a close confidant who had shared his secrets, and eventually his bed. He'd resisted her seductions at first, remained devoted to his wife and child, but his resistance had quickly waned. Now the two practically lived together in a palatial villa taken from the old planetary governor, and Elisa Caron and her daughter remained in the tiny drafty room where she and Remy had lived before the revolution. Remy had visited a few times, mostly to see his daughter Zoe, but he hadn't been to see her for months now either.
I'd like to see Bernard and his troublemakers crushed as much as you, but we're doing everything we can, and the Confederation envoys have helped us triple our orbital defense capability. You know as well as I do the Union will be back and with more strength than last time.
You misunderstand me, Lemmy.
She reached out and stroked her fingers gently down his face.
I'm not saying the Confederation visitors weren't useful, or that they didn't help us considerably, but Hoover himself said there was very little chance of getting any new ships through the blockade. And we have all the specifications they brought with them. The factories have been modified and producing for several months now.
A cold feeling moved through Caron's gut.
What are you saying, Amy? I'm just wondering if we need to take the risk of our Confederation friends misinterpreting Henri Bernard's lies and propaganda.
You aren't suggesting we... He couldn't even finish what he was thinking.
Who would know?
She grinned at him playfully. Even as deeply under her spell as he was still unnerved at the casual way she could suggest murder.
We need the Confederation, Amy.
Do we?
Come on, you're not being serious.
I'm very serious. The Confederation is far away. They were able to take advantage of the Union's disorder to get us some supplies and advisors, but it's unlikely they'll be able to contact us any time in the